Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Not even 36 hours after the election result, and already so much change. The first appointments. Is Rahm Emanuel post-partisan, even post-Clinton? The first international tough guy flare-up, spelled P-U-T-I-N. The first 500-point plunge in the Dow. We'll see if they get the second one today. So we continue our coverage this morning, first with Marcus Mabry, New York Times international economics correspondent and author of books including Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, and Raihan Salam, co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. He's an associate editor of The Atlantic and the New America Foundation and writes at Forbes.com. Hi, guys.
Good morning.
Hi, Brian.
And before we move on to the first bout of transition politics and the fierce urgency of the financial crisis, Marcus, your biography of Condoleezza Rice was called Twice as Good. How did that apply to her, and did it apply to the Obama campaign in the same way?
You know, I think it did. I think it was very instructive. We saw Condoleezza Rice come out yesterday, and many people have seen the clip online or on television where she was clearly very, very moved to say both what this meant for America and what it said about America, that we were a country that was constantly searching to become that perfect union, whether or not we ever could reach that or not. And then she added a note. She said, specifically, as an African-American, I am deeply proud and deeply moved. This is a woman who grew up in segregated Alabama. That idea of twice as good, I think I chose that as the title of my book because that's what motivated her. That's what made her who she is today. I think Barack Obama...
That as a black woman interested in the height of power or influence in foreign affairs, she felt she had to be twice as good as her white peers?
Her growing up in segregated Birmingham, a middle-class neighborhood, the adults told them all they had to be twice as good. Because they were black, they had to be twice as good as white people to be considered equal. And to be considered better, you had to be three times as good. And they weren't told that's unfair or anything. They were just told that's the way it is. I think Barack Obama very much epitomizes that way of thinking, and his rise to where he's risen to now, the presidency of the United States, actually says to native-born African-Americans, as well as immigrants, obviously, but immigrants always knew it, I think. It says to those of us who were descended from African slaves, like myself, like Condoleezza Rice, not like Barack Obama, but it says to us, you know what? You can do anything. You can be anything.
So how does this apply to the Obama presidency? Because all we really know him as so far is a campaigner.
And he's been a phenomenal campaigner. I think what we've seen is this campaign was, as we've said, I think many times, nearly flawless, whether it was raising record amounts of money, whether it was having an amazing amount of message discipline that we've never seen on the Democratic side probably ever in a race, whether it was his ability to keep his own emotions in check, which I think has a lot to do with being the experience of being a black man in a white world in America. All those things, I think, that kind of attention to perfection, I think we're also going to see in the White House. I think it's going to make a great difference in their ability to govern. And frankly, I think it's going to be bad news for the Republicans because I think Rahm Emanuel is the guy, don't forget, who put together that 2006 Democratic recapturing of the House. He's the guy who figured out how to get conservative Democrats elected in conservative parts of this country. That smart politics, I think, will be a part of everything they do in this White House.
Raihan Salam, you wrote on SIFY.com, if that's the way you pronounce it, SIFY.com, on Election Day, that you would not vote for Obama, even though the McCain campaign really let you down, especially in terms of economic policy. So where did you wind up this campaign, intellectually and emotionally, to come to that decision?
Well, that's a very complicated, tough question to answer. I hope for the best for the Republican Party. I believe in it as a vehicle of cultural conservatism and also as a vehicle of a kind of aspirational politics. But at the same time, John McCain ran a campaign that I don't think was worthy of John McCain, not because I think, as many liberals do, that it was, you know, uniquely McCarthyite or, you know, uniquely unfair or terrible in any way, but rather because It lacked focus, it lacked direction, and it lacked a really compelling narrative as to why you should choose John McCain's vision for the future of our country, for the future of our domestic institutions, which I think is the area that Republicans have really neglected. So overall, I felt pretty disaffected, and I don't think I was alone in that regard. So it was a tough night. At the same time, I mean, one can't help, the enthusiasm was infectious. And, you know, as a younger American, someone, you know, for whom, you know, this was a truly momentous event for many of the people I'm close to, I mean, I have some cautious optimism, though, you know, I fundamentally disagree with core aspects of Barack Obama's vision for where the country needs to go. I just hope, and I think we're going to find out a lot over the course of the cabinet selections, that he tries to pursue a moderate, cautious course. And I think there's good reason to believe he will.
Well, do you mean with respect to taxes, or your book, Grand New Party, said Republicans needed to attract what you called Sam's Club voters? They may be the only winners in this election, by the way, judging by the news in the Times today that Walmart may be the only company to do well this Christmas season. But these Sam's Club voters, they went for Barack Obama. The numbers were staggering in terms of the different economic demographic groups that went for Barack Obama despite all the Joe the Plumber campaigning. Do you think they're in for an early disillusionment because of his economic policies?
I think that it's very hard to tell. I think that if we have broadly shared economic growth, if that somehow manages to kick up, that's going to be good for everyone in the country. But I think that the particular mix of policies that I think non-college educated workers want are, you know, a kind of distinctive set of policies that I think neither party is really pursuing. I think when you look at the emphasis of the Obama campaign, I think that in some respects, you know, they have a pretty sane and responsible tax policy. But I also think that, you know, for example, you know, the emphasis on tuition tax credits, you know, is attractive to a lot of middle-class parents. But is that really the best way to use some scarce resources, given that I don't think that credit constraints are really the big problem in access to higher education? And also there's the matter of, you know, if you look at Generation Y, this generation that turned out in force for Barack Obama, half of these kids aren't college bound. So do we really have ladders for those kids? And by the way, I just want to stress that I don't think Republicans have very good answers to these questions either.
Uh-huh.
But I just, you know, worry about how the political imperatives cut against some of what I see as the policy imperatives.
We can take your phone calls and online comments for Raihan Salaam, author of Grand New Party, and New York Times international economics correspondent Marcus Mabry, 212-433-WNYC, here on the second day after the election of Barack Obama, 212-433-9692, or post your questions or comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Raihan, Marcus, we see this debate breaking out already in the country about whether it's the right time to raise taxes on the investor class in an economic downturn. Do you see a similar debate taking place in terms of international economics, your beat, or are they just focused on other things with this global financial downturn?
Well, actually, it's not even a debate internationally, which may not be surprising. The world is in a different place than the United States. Oftentimes, one of the slurs, would-be slurs, intended slurs that the McCain campaign used, certainly in the closing weeks of this campaign, was to paint Barack Obama as a quote-unquote socialist. Well, of course, you know, in Europe, you actually have lots of governments that are governed by socialists, literally socialists.
Right, but they
socialists.
Don't like that word either, do they? Because it comes with the overtone of tyranny, political tyranny.
Oh, well, you know, no. Europe is not living the Cold War anymore.
Yeah.
Europe is far beyond that. And in fact, the right-wing parties in most European countries are, in fact, left of the Democrats on our scale. So, and in Asia, it's not even an issue yet because they're still developing taxation policies. The belief is, yes, you tax people who can afford to pay taxes. I mean, that's not even a philosophical debate the rest of the world has. And so we are still very much unique in that regard.
But doesn't it diminish growth? Here is Obama economics advisor Austin Goolsbee on this show last month. I told him that even the New York Times editorial page, much to my shock, said the financial meltdown makes this a bad time to raise taxes on the investor class.
If the economy needs a bigger tax cut, the right way to do that, in Senator Obama's view, is give more tax relief to the 95% of people who've been squeezed. It's not let's go give additional tax cuts to very highest income people. That's exactly the approach. It's the oldest page in the Republican playbook. It says, when you get in trouble, cut taxes for the highest income people and the biggest corporations and count on that trickling down. That's exactly what George Bush did for the last 8 years, and it didn't work. The experience we're in now shows you that is a job killer, not a job creator.
The experience we're in now shows us that is a job killer, not a job creator. Raihan Salam, are you cringing? I can't see you over the phone.
I think that for the next 6 months or so, I think that I'm prepared to give these guys the benefit of the doubt. I think that, you know, they're going to need a wide berth in order to pursue a wide variety of economic policies. And I think that we're in a moment when you see, you know, strange coalitions emerging. You're seeing lots of Republicans, for example, saying that we need pump priming domestic infrastructure spending, for example. And you're seeing just a lot of shifts, a lot of moving pieces. And I mean, you know, from my vantage point, I just think that, you know, trying a lot of different things and seeing what works isn't crazy. I also think that, you know, when you look at, you know, one of the great lost opportunities for me of the campaign was the fact that, you know, McCain and the Republicans didn't develop a very coherent alternative to the bailout plan. As you guys know, you know, in Georgia, for example, the Senate race was unusually tight because the Republican senator backed the bailout plan. And I think that that discontent, you know, needed some kind of focus. And I didn't think that Republicans gave it one because I don't think they thought deeply enough about the questions it raised. So, you know, again, I mean, I'm kind of uneager to kind of shoot these guys down because we all hope that they turn the economy around.
You want to see what they do. And that was interesting about Saxby Chambliss, who I guess it looks like faces a runoff. He voted for the bailout. All the members of the Georgia House delegation voted against it. And again, in terms of global economics, Marcus Mabry, it is one of the first jobs of the Obama administration to figure out how they manage the bailout money. What are they actually going to spend this $700 billion on?
Exactly.
Are world markets looking to see what the answer to that question is?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of it would be hilarious if it weren't such a lot of money we were talking about is the fact that don't forget that, you know, everyone, Republicans and Democrats, you know, kind of rammed this down the public's throat by saying that we need this bailout because we need to buy up the bad assets that the banks have. And then all of a sudden, that's not what we're using the money for. We're going to use the money instead to recapitalize our banks, which is what Europeans did. Now, so this one thing we had to do, emergency, all of a sudden, we're not going to use that method. We're going to use a totally different method. And kind of, you know, no one kind of shirked or anything. I think Ryan is exactly right. Right now, the Republicans have, I think, a philosophical problem because right now, practically, you have to do certain things, maybe a stimulus package, maybe an infrastructure building package, which go against conservative, you know, fundamentals of conservative economics. And the Republicans don't seem to have kind of like, well, what do we do instead? Do we abandon our principles? Or, you know, no one has really articulated that. McCain didn't, and no one has, and I think someone has to on the Republican side of it. At the same time, I think, however, we are in such extraordinary times. The next year, I think Ryan had said, you know, if there were to be broad growth, you know, through different classes, it'll be, you know, good for all.
Yeah, well, good luck.
There won't be any, yeah. And the next year, it's going to be blood on the streets like we have not seen, most of us in our lifetimes. We're headed for a horrible recession. There are going to be millions of Americans laid off in the next 12 months. This is going to be an extraordinary time, and it's going to need extraordinary answers. And I don't know if anyone has them yet, but the Obama to-be administration has got to be working on, you know, what those might be.
Marcus Mabry, New York Times international economics correspondent, Raihan Salam from The Atlantic and the New America Foundation, and author of Grand New Party, How the Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. I was shocked to read in the Wall Street Journal yesterday their editorial page, post-election morning, slamming the Bush administration on the roots of the financial crisis. It's one thing to hear Austin Goolsbee do it. It's another thing to see it in the Wall Street Journal on the editorial page. And along with this analysis of the voting results, reading now, McCain actually lost less ground than many expected compared to Mr. Bush in 2004 among voters earning less than $50,000 a year. However, he was crushed compared to Mr. Bush among voters earning more than $75,000. The very members of the investor class who have watched their 401ks and IRAs plummet in value. They write, many Republicans will want to believe that they are victims of a financial ambush that they could do nothing about, but the panic actually began in late 2007, and its roots go back to the causes of the housing bubble. Republicans, specifically Mr. Bush's Federal Reserve nominees and Treasury secretaries, forgot about the value of money. What a line. Forgot about the value of money. They failed as stewards of the dollar, unleashing a credit mania and panic that collided in colossal bad timing with the presidential campaign. So, Marcus Mabry, how about that analysis of the timeline, that the panic actually began in late 2007 and tracing it to the Bush Treasury secretaries?
Oh, I think, looking at the fundamentals of conservative economics, that makes perfect sense. The value of money has to do with credit. And when credit is too loose, when you encourage profligacy and risk-taking, and that is, again, a basics of conservative economics. It's, I think, one of the reasons right now in the House of Representatives that will take its seats in January 2009, there will not be one single Republican from New England. New England was once the bedrock of the Republican Party. It was a Republican Party, however, that was fiscally conservative, that believed above all else in the value of money. That Republican Party was decimated, and I think now we're going to see, does the party find rebuild that part of itself or not, or abandon it for a social conservatism?
Raihan?
Well, I mean, I hate to be so analytical and windy, but I also wonder, yes, there were a lot of missteps, and I actually agree with the journal with regard to the value of sound money. I think that we did have a very loose policy. I think that people forgot about the specter of inflation in a way that was unwise, and that's really impacted stressed middle and working class families in a very, very bad way, as we're seeing right now. But I also think that, a lot of economic life, like life in general, is a learning process. And I think that certainly regulators should have pressed for more transparency. But I also think we shouldn't forget that we saw a great deal of innovation over the last 8 years. We saw a great deal of economic change that has actually really contributed to our well-being, and that's going to contribute to our well-being going forward. So, yes, when you have a spate of, new financial institutions, you're going to have some sort of crisis. Perhaps you're going to have a very large crisis. But the question is, in the absence of those new innovations, would we actually be better off? So, I mean, Marcus knows a lot more about the financial markets than I do, and I think that you do see a lot of very grim signs that we're going to have a rough recession. At the same time, I think that, you've seen some, pretty sharp people, Casey Mulligan, an economist at the University of Chicago among them, who are arguing that the state of the non-financial economy is not fundamentally that bad. When you look at the marginal productivity of capital, when you look at, yes, as John McCain said, a lot of the fundamentals of our economy, and I realize this is something that, one is going to be mocked for, but I think that, I'm confident that within, about 2 or 3 years, you're going to see this economy turn around, and you're hopefully going to see an economy that's leaner, more productive, and a regulatory environment that's going to have learned a lot of very hard lessons that are going to serve us well going forward.
Since you do political economic class analysis, Raihan, why do you think the investor class voted so heavily for Obama if he threatens their profits with things like capital gains tax hikes?
Well, I think that, a lot of these policies are notional. I think that when you look at Barack Obama's coalition, note that, as the journal pointed out, he won a lot of those voters making, reasonably high incomes, double income professional couples, et cetera. And these are people who are actually very tax sensitive. So when those policies are actually going to be hashed out, I think it's an open question whether or not they're really going to be very heavily burdened by the changes that we're going to see in tax policy. But I also think that, fundamentally, the investor class, I mean, it's funny. I think the kind of journalist theory of what the investor class is a little bit off, because when you have a lot of people entering the financial markets during a very successful, bull run, they're not necessarily going to understand that, yes, you may gain sometimes, you make losses at other times. They're going to be looking for people to blame. So I think that Eliot Spitzer's very kind of aggressive anti-Wall Street, investor populism was just as plausible in investor politics as the idea that, the so-called investor class is going to always embrace free market policies.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to continue in a minute with Raihan Salam and Marcus Mabry, and we're going to start hitting the news of the day. Barack Obama himself laid kind of low yesterday, meeting in private with some of his advisors, but everybody else took the opportunity to speak up. Vladimir Putin in a very big way. We'll talk about that. Hamid Karzai already asking for a change in Afghanistan policy. And Nancy Pelosi was out making the media rounds yesterday. We'll play a clip of the House Speaker and ask, was she sort of speaking for Barack Obama or sort of lobbying him in this interview with NPR? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on this day after the election of Barack Obama. And what will President Obama actually change by 2012? We're still collecting your predictions for our online time capsule. Post your answers to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. What will President Obama actually change by 2012? And we will dredge this up in 4 years and see how it compares to reality. For example, someone wrote, Barack Obama will help send the Washington culture of permanent campaigning to an undignified death as he changes the landscape from blue and red states into a purple country. As a result, the new breed of politicians will put their energy into governing as opposed to running for office. That's Monica from Montville's prediction for what President Obama will really change by 2012. What's yours? Click on Brian Lehrer Show. When you go to WNYC.org, you'll see the page for our What Will President Obama Actually Change time capsule. As we talk to Times Economics, International Economics Editor Marcus Mabry and Raihan Salam, co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. And apropos of that post, Raihan, let me get your take on some of the first day news stories after the election. Rahm Emanuel offered the job of chief of staff. He's a Bill Clinton White House fierce partisan. How does that conform to Obama's pledge and Monica's prediction to end government as a permanent campaign?
I think it would be odd for Barack Obama to switch from campaign mode because he's extremely good at it. And I think that, you know, we think of campaigning as a bad thing, but I think, you know, viewed from the perspective of someone who comes from a background as an organizer, I think it makes a lot of sense for him if he really does believe, and we don't really know exactly where he stands on the ideological spectrum, and I don't mean that in any bad or unflattering way, but, you know, if he really wants to build a long-term progressive majority in this country, of course you try to grow that by inches. And Rahm Emanuel's great contribution, you know, at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, for example, was reaching out to lots of Democrats who are pro-gun, pro-life, who really fit the cultural mood in what had been Republican districts. So I think that this is a shrewd pick. I also think that Rahm Emanuel is an unusually tough guy who lots of Democrats strongly dislike, you know, particularly in some of the kind of activist corners of the party, because they feel that he doesn't really listen to or care about their interests. He really cares about extending the power and reach of the Democratic brand, and he's willing to make compromises to get there. So, I mean, this is a very political choice, a very tough choice, and a demonstration that Barack Obama means business.
Marcus Mabry?
I agree with everything Raihan just said. I think that's exactly right. And I think there some folks are saying, oh, he's a conservative. Yeah, he's a partisan. You know, he's going to bring this Chicago politics, quote unquote. I heard that phrase a lot on Hannity and Combs last night on Fox News. He's a part, you know, Chicago politics and bring this partisan lefty liberal, blah, blah, blah. All, I think, a bunch of bunk. I think that Raihan is exactly right. I think he is a strategic operator who's going to actually not use these kind of litmus tests that would actually limit the Democrats' coalition.
Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday on the Democratic agenda.
I'm in communication with the White House about such a stimulus package to grow our economy by creating jobs, to do it in a newer, greener way, to recognize the unemployment situation in our country by extending unemployment insurance, to understand that people are hungry in America, and provide additional emergency food assistance, and to give help to the states for their health needs, for seniors and children, and other needs that they have.
Nancy Pelosi at a news conference in communication about the kind of stimulus package that she would want to see. To grow the economy by creating jobs, to do it in a newer, greener way, to recognize the unemployment situation by extending unemployment insurance, to understand that people are hungry in America and provide additional emergency food assistance, and to give help to the states for their health needs for seniors and children. That's a very specific kind of economic stimulus that she's laying out with very specific elements, Marcus. And I guess one of the first big decisions will be what kind of economic stimulus, because we hear those on the one hand. On the other hand, an op-ed in the New York Post today says focus on housing to figure out the bottom of the housing market and what homes are really worth. do aid to the states and rebuild a manufacturing base. It's a very different vision than what Nancy Pelosi was talking about in terms of a lot of the short-term relief like unemployment and food aid.
Well, but Nancy, that's exactly right. I mean, what Nancy Pelosi is talking about is truly, truly short-term stuff. Rebuilding the manufacturing base is quite a long-term prospect.
Right.
And so you're talking about very different kinds of stimulus.
So what was in that op-ed by Wilbur Ross was, for example, spend a lot more money on manufacturing R&D, industrial R&D. Again, that's a lot different than extending unemployment benefits.
It is. And the first challenge of this administration is going to be deciding what the priorities are. I think in some ways, frankly, I think they're given some cover by the fact that for the next 70 days, the President of the United States is George W. Bush, and his administration will take the blame for whatever stimulus package is cobbled together down there in Capitol Hill before Inauguration Day. And I think we will see a stimulus package cobbled together during the lame duck session of Congress. But, you know, the Obama administration will only have kind of partial responsibility for that, and that might be to the good for them. Whereas when they take office, whether or not they'll be able to actually have a stimulus package of their own is in doubt, given the vast size of the deficit that we're doing by all the spending we have to do for these emergency measures to save our financial economy. And then the question is, you know, what's going to be left to spend? And that's a question I think that especially is going to drive the few economic conservatives that still exist in our country, and I know they're out there. It's going to drive them insane because we're spending like there's no tomorrow and as if we can just keep printing money. Well, the long-term implications of all this, all these bailouts, all this money we're spending on inflation and eventually on the United States' ability to actually sell our own debt and our own debt ratings, in the long term, we're going to pay a price for this. This is not free.
Listeners, we can take some of your calls and comments on what we've been discussing here so far this morning with Marcus Mabry, New York Times International Economics Editor, and Raihan Salam from The Atlantic and the New America Foundation and author of the book Grand New Party, 212-433-WNYC, especially on the economic stimulus. What kind of economic stimulus would you like to see, especially on your reaction to the job offer of Chief of Staff to Rahm Emanuel and John Podesta, also from the Clinton team, as the head of the transition team, and on these Afghanistan and Russia development specifically aimed at the president-elect. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. Raihan Salam, do you think that Nancy Pelosi there was speaking in a way for Obama and his priorities when he was laying low yesterday, or was she kind of lobbying Obama for a wing of the Democratic Party?
I think that it is a little bit more the latter than the former, and I think that works well for both of them because I think that Barack Obama is still, you know, playing things close to the vest. I think that he is going to offer a very comprehensive picture of the kind of stimulus that he wants to see, and we're also going to have a much better picture of the kind of economic direction he wants to see when he names his economic team, which I assume is not going to be too long from now. I think that a lot of what we heard from Nancy Pelosi sounded to me like boilerplate, but at the same time, some of these things like extending unemployment insurance benefits, I think that, you know, it's very easy to imagine a Republican Congress doing the same thing because that's, you know, some very basic pump-priming stuff that's going to get a lot of bang for the buck. Overall, I mean, you know, I am one of those remaining few economic conservatives that Marcus was talking about, and I think that, you know, I'm just hoping that we hear more of Obama and less of Pelosi in the years to come, but I guess we'll see what happens.
I think that will be the metric we should all keep track of.
but seriously, friction there, Marcus?
Oh, I think there will be friction there, and I think as Raihan said, I think it'll be to the good of the Obama administration that there is friction because it will allow them to not triangulate, which is a horrible phrase. And that, of course, is Bill Clinton's use of the Republicans on the Hill and the Democrats on the Hill when he was in office to see where would they go, and then he'd go in the middle. It's not going to be that kind of calculation, I don't think, but it will be a smart politics of a kind of, I think, coalition building. But I do think it will serve their needs to have Nancy Pelosi over there with a more kind of liberal agenda. I think it will make them look more respectable or acceptable, excuse me, to much of the country. I do think the risk politically here is what will liberal parts of the party, left-wing parts of the party, not to say progressive parts of the party, of the Democratic Party, what will they think of this administration a year from now? again, in which I think I expect millions of Americans to lose their jobs in the next 12 months. And will the agenda, will the answers, will the answers to the pain we're about to see, will it be enough for the people who supported Obama who were from the left? I don't know if it will be. I think he will have an ability. He's already said it's going to be a long, hard road. He's already said, and the first time speaking to the nation, to the world, in fact, as president-elect, that these will be difficult times and that he will call for sacrifice and that he cannot do it alone. He'll need all of us. We've not been talked to that way in a very, very long time in this country. And I think there might be a reservoir, actually, of goodwill and of even wanting to sacrifice if we feel it's worth something.
And he did call very explicitly for sacrifice in his victory speech on Tuesday night. From our comments page, comment one, any chance of a New Deal? Comment two, no chance. Comment 11, it looks like from some of the above comments that it is dawning on people that Obama is a centrist, not a left winger. All of the socialist charges had me cracking up. Look at his record, folks. There really should not be any surprises. Bob in, I'm sorry. That was going to be, all right, we'll take Bob in. Where are you, Bob? Cliffwood Beach?
Right, Cliffwood Beach, New Jersey, right across the bay from New York.
Hey, Bob.
I think that what I'm hoping is that this is finally the death of supply-side economics, which I think is the original cause of all the bubbles that we've seen that have burst on us. If 70% of the economy depends on consumers, then it only makes sense that any recovery plans stimulate the incomes of the people who are actually going to go out and spend the money.
Anyone? Well, let's... Go ahead, Reihan, real quick.
Well, I mean, just I see where you're coming from, but I've got to say, when people complain about the bubbles that we've seen over the last 28 years, I get a little confused sometimes because, for example, that telecommunications bubble, well, we have all that fiber optic cable that companies like Google used after the boom that, you know, if Nazi Germany wanted to devastate the United States in World War II, they wouldn't have dropped gleaming new factories on our shores. That wouldn't have been the way to devastate our economy. Yet, you know, people often talk about how we have an investment overhang, how we have, you know, too much housing. Well, too much housing means that there's going to be relatively low-cost housing for lots of those modest, struggling middle-class families that want to get on the property ladder. So a lot of things that, you know, people are describing as nightmarish and really grim for us, you know, are things that are going to look decently good to us, particularly to the shrewder among us, particularly the kind of people who are going to get the economy growing again in a couple of years. So I don't always get it.
Bob, thank you. Alexis in Red Bank, you're on WNYC.
Hi. My comment is to Rohan. And Rohan.
Reihan.
Reihan, I'm sorry. I don't think you do get it. You seem to speak in a way that's kind of above the experience of the average person. I am the household that earns over $75,000, and in fact, we would pay more tax under an Obama administration. And both my husband and I did vote for Obama. Your comment earlier was that, you know, the investing class perhaps is not understanding that they can both win and lose. I think, one, that's, you know, an underestimation of the average investor. We certainly understand that. And two, we vote for Obama because we believe in a moral obligation to possibly pay more tax and to do better than what we've done. I think we can all agree, no matter who won this election, sacrifice was going to be required regardless. But the fact that I would pay more to help someone, you know, the least among us, is fine by me. But certainly I did not do that by accident and think that I did not understand that I would possibly lose financially.
Reihan, go ahead.
You know something, you've got to understand that, you know, when you're on the radio, there's a danger of sounding glib. If we were having a conversation together, you know, it would be pretty different. I think that, you know, you understand those things and you believe those things very sincerely. There are also people who, for example, want to pay less tax, who also give a lot more money to their church or give a lot of money to social service agencies in their community.
But as Brian pointed out, those people who are going to pay more tax and those people in $75,000 incomes and more voted for Obama, they clearly understood their choice.
Well, look, I'm not saying that they don't understand their choice, but I'm saying that there are a lot of things at work, and things change when you actually start feeling that tax bite, depending on whether or not...
The bite will hurt in this house. It's not that the bite comes easily.
There are also a lot of people, for example, like my parents, who were very happy when Mike Bloomberg passed a property tax increase. And I understand that because, you know, people want to, they want to be spoken to like adults. They want to be taken seriously. And when they recognize that, so I agree with you that the Bush tax policies have been silly because all they're doing is cutting taxes on the rich now so future generations can pay those taxes in the future. I don't think that's a sound or reasonable tax policy. Yeah. I'm just saying that there are a lot of Democrats who are sensitive to the bite of the alternative minimum tax, for example. And one of the things that Barack Obama and the Democrats have explicitly said, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, is that they're going to try to solve that problem for a lot of middle and upper middle class families. But solving that problem means that you're taking some revenues off the table. I'm just saying that there are some tough choices, and you understand lots of things that other people don't necessarily understand. So I think that, you know, there's a danger in me speaking on behalf of other people mm-hmm. and a little bit on you speaking on behalf of other people, too.
Alexis, thank you very much for the call. And, you know, I wonder, there is that breakdown stat in the Times that some of this conversation has been based on, Marcus, that showed people making over $75,000 voted very much. I got it from the Wall Street Journal editorial that in what they call the investor class, the 75,000 plus, voted largely for Barack Obama and much more than they voted for Kerry in 2004. What they didn't break down was people making 75,000 plus who knew they were voting against their own or believed they were voting against their own economic interests but thought they were doing it for the good of the country. So, you know, if that's the Alexis demographic, it would be fascinating to find out how many people thought their own taxes. Of course, the policy is it's 250,000 plus, not 75,000 plus, where the taxes are supposed to go up.
And that was hammered away very, very often.
Although capital gains makes it potentially different from that and lower.
And so does the whole idea that, you know, we're talking here about the New York area. It's different, I think, too. Someone
also
making $75,000, perhaps in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
But we should define economic interest here, I think, more broadly, because I think what Alexis was getting at was that many people do see their economic interest not to be narrowly defined. It's not just how much
exactly.
I pay in taxes.
Right.
It's much larger than that.
Yes. And we're going to run out of time in this segment, but you could keep this going on our comments page. Anybody who's in that category yourself, 75,000. No, let's put it this way. Anybody think that your economic outlook is going to be worse and voted for Obama anyway? Or if you make 75,000 plus, do you think his policies will make your personal economic outlook better? Keep this going at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Before we run out of time, just real quick. Marcus, Russia's President Medvedev, spelled P-U-T-I-N, saying he would send arms to the border with Poland if Obama goes through with the Bush missile defense there. What position does that leave Obama in?
I think he leaves in the position of shutting up and waiting and seeing and taking his time and not being goaded into any responses by Russian figureheads.
Hamid Karzai asking Obama to stop the airstrikes that are killing civilians.
Again, I don't mean to sound cynical here, but I think just from a realpolitik foreign policy point of view, I think you sit back and let the Bush administration be there's one president at a time. For the next 70 days, it will be George W. Bush will be the president. I think you let that policy continue, and you don't. You discuss certainly strategically whether or not one will do that once one is in office. In the meantime, you have the fig leaf of another administration being in office, and you let them wage American foreign policy.
Reihan, you wanted a piece of that?
This really makes me nervous because I think that there have been smart people within the Bush White House who've been thinking about alternatives to airstrikes that are going to involve higher casualties of U.S. troops. And I think that I wouldn't want to see this become a political football. And I really want to see some consensus going forward on what the next steps are going to be in Afghanistan. But this is something I'm very, very nervous about because I can see this becoming a really ugly political football.
Last thing. The New York Post says maybe Robert Kennedy Jr. for head of the EPA and Caroline Kennedy for UN ambassador. Any reaction, Reihan?
I think that there are a lot of strong Democrats who could fill those roles. And while I understand the affection, the deep affection for the Kennedy family, it's not obvious to me that those would be the strongest candidates for those jobs. So I do hope that Barack Obama is looking to a wide variety of people.
Marcus, I think Christine Todd Whitman would be a radical choice, I think, for EPA. That's a Republican who left because she wasn't respected and the mission wasn't respected in this administration.
Raihan Salam, co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, associate editor of The Atlantic, and he's at the New America Foundation. Marcus Mabry, New York Times international economics editor and author of books including Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice, and Her Path to Power. Thank you both very much.
Thanks a lot,
Brian. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. It's time to take a break from all this politics and stretch. Or not. New evidence shows stretching before exercise may be bad for you. We'll talk about it in a minute.